It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the show, a look at the bill before the U.S. Senate that targets discrimination against gay, lesbian, and transgender employees.
First, are kids spending too much time in front of screens? A new report from the American Academy of Pediatrics offers guidelines for kids, parents, and doctors, calling in part for limits on screen time.
And we want to hear from you about this. Do you think kids and teens spend too much time on tablets, phones, TV, and other technology? How has your family dealt with the issue? Strict limits, anything goes, or somewhere in between? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Dr. Victor Strasburger is with us now. He's a pediatrician, fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and he's co-author of the new report we're talking about. It's called Managing Media, We Need a Plan. Dr. Strasburger, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, your report, the subtitle, We Need a Plan, you say, when it comes to kids and technology, but do you think most families have a plan in place?
Not only do most families not have a plan, most parents aren't, I think, aware of how much media their kids are using or what media their kids are using, what they're seeing online or on TV or in movies.
What as a parent should we be worried about when we kind of go too far with too much screen time?
There are any number of health effects. Obviously, media can be quite pro-social and good, Sesame Street being the classic example for young children. But too much of anything is not a great idea, and kids are spending between 7 and 11 hours a day with a variety of different media. That exposes them to a lot of media violence, a lot of sex and sexuality, a lot of drug advertising, and makes them more likely to be obese.
So, yeah, let's follow up on the health consequences there, because it seems like 7 to 11 hours is a lot, and that seems like there could be more productive things to do with their time. But over the long run, what kind of health problems are pediatricians worried about?
The one that I think is easiest to understand is obesity. There are studies that are ongoing as long as 37 years in duration showing that the time you spend in front of a TV set before you're age 5 or 6 or 7 is directly responsible for obesity when you're a teenager or an adult. And that controls for every other known factor of obesity.
You know, it's interesting because I've been involved in conversations and I've heard parents talking about how it seems like, you know, we're in the middle of a great experiment right now that nobody really has the information because so much of this technology is new. You've got things like iPhones and tablets that are new, DS, more sophisticated video games. Those have been around for a while, but there's never been this much technology, so many options all at once. So how do we know, you know, what the right thing is to do?
We have a lot of research. Sorry, my dogs are barking here.
They're welcome in the conversation, too.
I need to set them down in front of an iPad. cartoon. We have a lot of research. People are all kind of a Twitter about new technology, but in fact, there are thousands of studies on old technology, and kids spend more time and will always spend more time with television than they will with any other technology because television is entertaining and it tells a story. What's different is the kids are accessing television on their iPads or their cell phones.
Is there a difference or a sense that there's a difference between passively observing a TV show, whatever kind of screen we're watching it on, and doing something like a computer game where you're interacting with it? Or is it pretty much in the same ballpark?
No, it's different. And you can take that question a little bit farther and say, is it different playing an educational video game or a first-person shooter video game? And the answer is obviously yes. There are some incredibly violent video games out there. California tried to restrict the sale of violent video games to kids. They didn't write a very good law, and the Supreme Court overturned it 7-2. But video games are like any other media. There are some extraordinarily good pro-social video games, and there are some horrible video games for kids.
So what parents listening, I'm sure, want to know is, what is the right amount? What did you find?
The right amount is less than 2 hours a day of entertainment screen time. That means movies, TV shows and video games. We're not talking about time spent texting. Who knows? You know, we know that a third of teenagers send an average of 100 texts per day, but we're not, there's no good data on how much texting is too much texting, except when your thumbs fall off. We're talking about entertainment screen time, less than 2 hours a day, doesn't include computer time for homework, doesn't include cell phone use or texting, just simple screen time.
Now, you covered a wide age range, I think, in your recommendations. Starting at the earlier end, how young is too young for any kind of screen time?
Two. Age two. There are about a dozen studies now that babies exposed to screens may be more likely to have language delays. And I can tell you, I can walk into an exam room with a 6, 8, 9 month year old baby to do a well child check, and I can tell you which babies are watching TV and which babies are being read to.
Why is that? Is that because they're not interacting with parents?
They're not interacting with me. The babies who are read to are sitting up, looking at me, chirping away, talking, vocalizing, interacting. The babies who are watching TV are blobs.
And this is, there is no caveat for educational TV here.
There are no studies yet. That doesn't mean there won't be one tomorrow, but there are no studies yet that you make your baby smarter by exposing them to TV or iPads or even, you know, as great as it is, even Sesame Street.
Interesting. Or Baby Einstein, I'm guessing. So there
right.
goes that.
Right.
So is the idea, you know, if you can hold off as long as you can, is that the best thing you can do for your child? Or is it something that, you know, is really explicit to 2 year olds and under?
The best thing you can do is read to your baby and interact with them. Babies are remarkably smarter than we give them credit for, something that Barry Brazelton taught me a long time ago in Boston. A baby, it's hard to believe, but a baby can tell the difference between a real person on a TV screen and a real person in person. And they learn from the person who's in front of them, because that person can interact with them, they assess facial features, reactions, things like that. Obviously, the person on the TV screen doesn't react to them. So avoiding screen time for kids under the age of two. And then the easiest thing for parents, and this is where I think parents don't understand what we're suggesting, is not to let a media habit get started. Keep the technology out of the bedroom, all of it. Limit total screen time. Watch with your kids and discuss the content.
We'll talk more about the content in a few minutes. We're talking to Dr. Victor Strasburger. He's a pediatrician and co-author of a new report calling for limits to screen time and technology access for kids and teens.
And we want to hear from you. Are you a parent or a child dealing with these issues, figuring out how much screen time is too much? And if you're a teacher or a pediatrician dealing with these issues, we'd like to hear from you as well. How does your family handle screen time? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a look at a proposed employment discrimination law in the U.S. Senate.
Now we continue our conversation with Dr. Victor Strasburger about kids, teens, and technology. How much screen time is too much? You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does your family manage technology, TV, tablets, smartphones, and the like? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Maria with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Maria.
Good evening. One of the comments that I really think is important is too often you see kids getting the tablets or the television or the computer games, and then they're taken away if they don't behave. And I think it should be used as a reward the other way, so that if homework is done, if you've done your chores, then you get an hour of time. And it does make an incredible difference. And I've seen it with my own grandchildren. Instead of when something goes wrong, having it taken away, as I've told my kids, use it as an incentive to get them to do the things they should be doing.
Okay, so use it as a reward, not a punishment. What do you think about that, Dr. Strasburger?
I think that's a great idea. We should have put that in the policy statement.
I wanted, before we get back to our callers at 800-642-1234, wanted to ask you about parents talking about the content with the kids. I think that's one of the guidelines. Why should parents do that?
This is really a parent family values issue. TV and movies are teaching your kids about all the things that you need to teach them about: sex, drugs, relationships with other people. Media are a very powerful teacher, and a lot of the content that you see on television, particularly, is not very good for them in terms of teaching those values. So if you object to that, you need to speak up, and it can replace the big talk. You're watching a sitcom on TV, something sexy comes in, you say, you know, what do you think about that? Why is she jumping into bed with him? Why aren't they talking about birth control? It eases the conversation very nicely, but you gotta talk to kids about it.
All right, we'll go back to our callers now. We have Jim with us in Colfax. Jim, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. See, my question would be, my wife sits with our two-year-old, 3-month-old, 2.3-year-old. Okay, so she sits with her in the evening for the last hour, hour and a half before she goes good night to bed. And she rocks her to sleep. And they sit and they watch, like on the iPhone, they watch cartoons and doing other things on there. And during the day, Grandma does the book reading and things like that while she's being babysat. Is there a proper mix that could be done for the amount of screen time compared to the book time, as you were talking about earlier?
All right. Thanks for that question, Jim. And in particular, I guess something you look at is bedtime use of that kind of media, too. What do you think about that, Doctor?
Bedtime use is not a great idea just because most of the content is very exciting, often involves violence, certainly involves, you know, rapid cutting and fast music and things that are going to keep your child awake. So not a good time. That's the good time to read. Now, there are some exceptions. There used to be a wonderful set of videos called Rabbit Tail videos that would use Hollywood movie stars to read classic children's tales. So they do Kipling and things like that. And you could read along with your child while you're watching the video. They were very soporific. I mean, we used them with our kids. They put kids to sleep quite nicely. So there are some videos like that. And, you know, obviously there are books like that, like Good Night Moon. Read that a few times to your kids and they'll be falling asleep before no time. And also the light of the TV screen is activating. Our brains respond to the light of the TV screen. So TV before bedtime is not a great idea. Reading before bedtime, much better idea.
I'll learn that lesson myself when I watch the Packer game right before bed tonight.
Yeah.
Speaking of too much excitement. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Rick in Grafton on the line. Hi, Rick.
Yes, I've got over 30 years' experience in technology as network engineer and security engineering. Two comments. The first one is, I can tell you, as I got busy and couldn't read to my son as much when he was younger versus my daughter, who's 5 years older, huge difference in their reading skills and struggle in school. My son is still struggling. The second thing, though, that's very important is, as I've helped family, friends, and others with their computer issues, I'm amazed at how many parents have no clue where their kids are going on the Internet. More than that, they'd never let their children talk to or interact with the seedy side of society. But yet, these kids are being exposed to the CD side, and the parents don't have any idea how to set the firewalls or security settings, or some say it's private to their teenagers, which I totally disagree with, and I'd like the doctor's view on that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Rick. A whole bag of worms there.
Oh, I think he's absolutely dead on, and I've said this before. If you have a 14-year-old son, and he's got a computer in his room, he's seen pornography. And if that upsets you, get the technology out of the bedroom. You know, people think that their kids are safe in front of the TV screen, and they aren't necessarily, or in front of the computer screen. These are potent teachers of kids. They can take them. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, I don't know about you two, but when I was growing up, the sexiest thing around was a Playboy magazine. Think about how today's internet is different from a Playboy magazine. And that tells you how concerned you ought to be.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Artis joining us in Delafield. Hi, Artis.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, we do have our computer in a public, you know, in a common room. That's one thing. But as far as, like, entertainment / technology, on the weekdays, if the homework is done, you can have, you know, a half an hour or one episode of your favorite TV show. But also reading on the technology, like on the Kindle, is basically the only unlimited thing that we have on the weekdays. And that's pretty simple, and that's kind of the way it was when I was growing up. We had the first video game systems, the Atari, the Intellivision, and it was the same way for me in my house. So it seems to work.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call. What do you think about that?
I'm a big fan of unlimited reading. If you want to get all of your children their own Kindle and see what they download and let them read to their little heart's content, I'm a big fan of that. I also do think the caller said something about this. I think there ought to be a house rule in every house in the United States that media don't go on until homework is done.
That's an interesting one. I mean, how, like, maybe this is outside the purview of what we're talking about here, but if you're a household that is already letting the kids watch some TV when they get home or play some video games when they get home from school before homework, how do you dial that back once the pattern's set?
Yeah, that's the problem, is you don't start in the first place. That's what a lot of parents ask is, you know, my teenager now has his own computer in his room, his own iPad, his own cell phone. What do I do now? And the answer is, you screwed up big time,
No. And
I don't know how to help you.
Oh, great. That's not what we wanted to hear. I mean, it's just kind of tough.
Say,
you have to make tough calls.
I will say that even if that all is true, the first thing you need to do is get a big basket, an Easter basket, and put it in the kitchen where there are a lot of electric sockets. And every night at 10 o'clock, the cell phones go night-night in the basket.
Hey, here's an email from Becky in Eau Claire. She writes, my 9-month-old loves FaceTime, or loves to FaceTime, I guess that's a program, on my iPad with relatives that live far away so they can chat online, especially grandma and grandpa. Is this screen time that should also be limited?
It's a good question, and I have no idea. Probably not. but we don't exactly know how babies react to people that they know on screen, except that the studies I mentioned, that real people in person are far better than people on the screen. So there's no research on this.
Do you have children?
I do, too.
So did you get into any trouble with them and have to backpedal, or do you feel
I did. I made a serious mistake with my son, who's now 23. He just turned 23. I had to think about it for a minute. He is absolutely a gentle giant. He is the sweetest kid. Everybody loves him. I kept him away from violent media until he was 12 or 13. The research says at least 8. So I you know, spaced it out a little bit more. But I made a mistake with him. I let him keep his cell phone in his bedroom, and we used to hear him getting texts all through the night, and he had trouble sleeping, and we couldn't get it away from him. It was terrible.
Well, that's a little reassuring. If you can do that, maybe the rest of us can correct our mistakes down the road too.
All right, well, we'll leave it there. Dr. Strasburger, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
That's Dr. Victor Strasburger, pediatrician, co-author of the new American Academy of Pediatrics report, Managing Media, We Need a Plan. Couple last comments from our listeners. Marion Platteville was on the line. She said no phones at the dinner table, board games instead. That's close to my heart, of course, as a big board game nerd.
And Gustav in Madison says the amount of media that parents use is also part of the problem. Parents should throw their TV away if they don't want their kids to get in the habit of watching it.
And Ashley on Facebook says, I don't allow any television on school nights, only on Friday night and Saturday, occasionally on Sunday. Well, you can keep those comments coming in, the Central Time on WPR on our Facebook page.
Coming up, a look at a proposed law targeting employment discrimination. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. The U.S. Senate is set to vote on ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which would federally ban bias in the workplace based on sexuality and gender identity.
With some Republicans backing the bill, more senators coming out in support of it today, ENDA appears to have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate.
The bill will still face hurdles in the House before any possibility of becoming law. Speaker John Boehner has voiced his opposition.
Gay rights did make news in the House today, though, with Representative Michael Michaud of Maine saying he's gay, becoming the seventh member of Congress to be openly gay, lesbian, or bisexual.
Here with us now to talk about the Employment Non-Discrimination Act is New York Times congressional reporter Jeremy Peters. Jeremy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So it looks like supporters are feeling pretty optimistic going in. How would you say it looks right now in the Senate?
Well, for the bill to clear this first hurdle, it looks like the supporters are guaranteed a victory. Now, of course, this is only the first step in what is going to be a multi-day process that will take us into the end of the week. But barring any kind of unforeseen troubles, it appears that the bill will overcome the filibuster by the end of the week and become law. I'm sorry, not become law. That is one thing that is quite uncertain. If this clears the Senate, it, of course, then would be it would need to go to the House in order for it to become law, and that appears highly unlikely at this point because of Republican opposition.
Now, we've seen this kind of legislation before. In the past, it has failed, and it seems as though this time the difference is that there is Republican support behind it, some of it up front, some of it sort of behind the scenes. Tell us a story about how that Republican support is playing out this time.
Well, it's been fairly muted, I would say. You have a handful, really. Four who came out prior to this weekend. Today, you had a fifth, Senator Dean Heller of Nevada, who said he would vote for this. Now, remember, that's only five of 45 Senate Republicans. It's not a huge amount, and it by no means points to any sort of overwhelming support in the Republican Party, at least it's contingent in Congress for gay rights legislation. Now, the people who have been working this bill on the Republican side, Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Mark Kirk of Illinois, of course, represent rather moderate states. So I think when you look to places kind of elsewhere in the country, states that are redder politically, this remains something that Republicans are very wary of supporting.
I've heard that there is some support, possible support, I should say, behind the scenes, Republicans who aren't declaring themselves. Are you seeing evidence of that, too?
I'm told that. Of course, nobody wants to say who has given them private assurances that they will vote for this. I can tell you, though, that gay rights supporters and sponsors of the bill in the Senate are pretty confident that they will get at least a handful more, that they could have somewhere in the order of six or eight Republicans who ultimately vote for this. And they have their sights set on Rob Portman of Ohio, who came out earlier this year in support of gay marriage after learning that his son is in fact gay. And then you have Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire, who also seems to be somewhat persuadable on this. Now, others that are probably a little bit less likely to go for it but have not been written off are John McCain of Arizona and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania.
Now, what arguments are the opposition making right now in terms of why they're still voting against it?
Well, that's interesting, because what you don't hear is a lot of the rhetoric around these battles that you would have heard 5-10 years ago. There's almost no condemnation of homosexuality, at least among those in the Senate. Republican senators are being very careful not to make this an issue of moral judgment. What they are doing is saying this bill will open the door to frivolous lawsuits and be a trial lawyer's bonanza. So that's the route that they have chosen to take, rather than kind of going in a more religious direction.
Now, it seems that there still are some misunderstandings, you know, reading, for instance, the New York Times today, people talking about employers having to pay for sex change operations, for instance, or, say, a Christian school having to hire someone who cross-dresses for that school. These are the types of concerns and misunderstandings that are still apparently dogging this process. Where would you say they're coming from?
Well, I don't want to leave you with the impression that there are not elements out there that are trying to make this an issue of homosexuality. There are religious conservative groups like the Family Research Council and others that are saying things like outright distortions, saying that this will allow children to be taught by men wearing dresses, or that this will allow pedophiles to be protected under the law. So there is that certainly happening. It's happening on the margins, and it's not something that I think a lot of people in the Senate on the Republican side are taking very seriously.
Now, it sounds like some Republicans have been concerned that if they didn't support this legislation, that the Republican Party would, you know, look out of step with the way that the country as a whole is feeling. Is that sort of what's driving the Republican support that we're seeing so far?
I think that's part of it. But, you know, when you look at the numbers, there are still 40 Republicans who are not sure that this is a good idea. So I don't know that they're all that concerned about looking out of step. I think that what the Republican sponsors are saying is this is an issue of fairness, and it's just kind of about time that they finally added gays, lesbians, bisexual people, transgender people to federal non-discrimination law. I mean, I think if you were to ask most Americans, are gay people protected under federal law, they would say yes, and that is not the case. It's not the case in 29 states, in fact. And so I think what you have more than any political calculation is really just a recognition that this should be done. It's a relatively straightforward law. It's not something that is as politically risky as, say, same-sex marriage, which, you know, interestingly enough, some of the Republican supporters of this bill do not support. Susan Collins of Maine, who has worked very hard to get people on her side of the aisle to support this, is not a supporter of same-sex marriage, but yet this is one issue that she has taken up very passionately. So there still are a lot of reservations around other gay rights issues in the Republican Party.
Do you have any idea how many states already have laws similar to End on the Books right now?
21 in the District of Columbia.
So is that, you know, part of why the support is there now as well, that this is something that, you know, a lot of people are already seeing in their states?
Yeah, because when they ask their constituents about this, their constituents assume that it's already the law. So I think for a number of them, they just don't see any political downside in doing this at all.
And what do you expect to happen as it starts its movement in the Senate?
Well, I think today it will be a first real test of how much Republican support it will have. You know, we know, or at least we think, it's going to get the 60 votes that it needs. It has now 5 Republicans who are on record as supporting it. It will be interesting to watch how many more, if any, come around. I know that supporters of the legislation feel optimistic they can get a handful more. And that could be a signal to people in the House of Representatives who might be wary of supporting this over there. Now, it will be very difficult to get this moving in the House. You know, it's the Republicans control everything over there. It's unlike the Senate, which is controlled by Democrats. And the Speaker, John Boehner, came out with a statement today saying that he is opposed to this legislation because he believes it would open the floodgates to lawsuits. So supporters of this legislation in the House hope that there is some backdoor way that they can flip this into a larger piece of legislation like the Defense Authorization Act, which will have to come up for a vote before the end of the year. Whether or not that happens, I would not bet on it at this point. It looks like a pretty difficult task. But still, regardless of what happens in the House, the Senate action, assuming that it ultimately passes in the Senate, will be significant because the Senate has not voted on a non-discrimination measure that includes gay people since 1996.
It's been a while. Well, we'll be watching it, and I'm sure you will too. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jeremy Peters, congressional reporter at the New York Times. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network.
Our next guest says there's a new movement on the rise. People are building and flying their very own drones, and it's a glimpse of what life might be like in the coming years when these small flying robots take over the skies.
Joining us now is Tara McKelvey. She's features writer for the BBC. We have a link to her piece, The Rise of the Drone Hobbyists, on our Facebook page. Tara, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So we've seen drones all over the international news, but how new of a phenomenon is recreational building of drones?
They've been around for a while. I mean, one of the questions is, what do you call these things?
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they're just, you know, model airplanes. But because, you know, drones have become so much, such a big story in the news that people call these model airplanes, they call them drones too. So they've been around for a while, since you were a kid probably.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of the same thing as a remote control airplane, essentially.
That's right. I mean, people who, you know, follow this field are very particular about the terms, but for the layman, drone can cover all of it.
So drones gotten kind of a negative connotation sometimes. It's something that is used for military purposes, spy purposes. What are some of the positive things people are doing with these off the battlefield?
Well, I mean, they can do all sorts of things. They can deliver a burrito. There's been a video out that shows them dropping a burrito, and you know, and journalists are dying to get their hands on them. Some journalists are using them now because they can do stories about weather and things like that and send the drone off into an area that's pretty dangerous. And also, like, real estate agents want to use them so they can look at property and make a better sale.
So what is the appeal to these hobbyists? It sounds like people are pretty passionate about them. It's not just localized United States. What is it that people are really enjoying and feel passionate about drones for?
I mean, it's cool. You know, you can make this thing go wherever you want it to go, and the videos show these amazing scenes where the drone's, you know, going in all these places, like around the Statue of Liberty, and you can pretend like you're, you know, flying in this crazy place that you're not supposed to be. So it's like a sneaky thing that you can control.
Well, that's an interesting question to bring up. If they're in sneaky places, if they're not supposed to be there, do people get into trouble flying these things around?
Well, there was a story of a woman who lives in the Pacific Northwest who said that there was a drone hovering outside her window. So it seems kind of creepy, and
yeah.
She complained. She wrote on a blog about it. So there's always that possibility.
Interesting. Well, has there ever been, you know, a sort of security flap over drones that we know about?
Different authorities, you know, across the country have different levels of comfort with these things. Sometimes they get pretty upset. Some of the drone enthusiasts who fly them around have gotten in trouble for them. They've been threatened with fines and so on because the drones have flown around. Like at University of Virginia, they flew around some buildings there, and the people who live there, the authorities, got pretty upset.
If I wanted to get into this hobby, what's my cost of entry? Is this a wealthy person's game?
No, it's cheap. You can build your own drone for about $500, but it's a pretty simple model. And also remember, there's a difference between these drones that you can build for cheap and that you can fly around your backyard, and the drones that do hard work, like the kind that a realtor would want or that a journalist would need. They're a little bit more sophisticated.
Now, we've been talking about some of the security issues, and the United States has been, with good reason, a little bit jumpy about airplanes in general in the last 10, 12 years. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, are there safety implications here just in terms of what a drone could do aside from privacy? You know, could it be something that was used to carry a weapon? Is it something that could injure the user as well?
I mean, both are true, that the weapons require like a pretty sturdy drone, and they also require a whole bunch of people to man it. So each of the drones that are used for Pakistan and other places where they're actually killing people, they have about 160 people behind them. And then the software is really complicated and sophisticated. So the idea that somebody could just sort of, you know, piece together a drone that's going to go out and kill people seems pretty unlikely. And that's also a question about proliferation. People are always worried that some kind of another country is going to get it and use it against us. But again, it requires a real outlay of resources. So it's not anything to worry about right now.
And what about the people who fly them themselves? Could they get hurt?
Yeah, I mean, they seem benign, and it seems like a lot of fun, but just, I guess, a couple months ago, there was a guy in Brooklyn who got killed by one of them. It ended up hitting the top of his head. It was pretty horrible. Mm. You know, it doesn't happen very often. It may be one of the only cases where it's happened.
So what, I imagine there's a variety. I can picture a model airplane flying around, but what do some of these different drones look like?
I mean, they're, you know, like, they don't look all that sophisticated. They just, you know, like they're just like these clunky kind of metal, all kind of whatever, taped together. You know, the sophisticated part comes in how they're controlled, you know, the software or the you know, the controls that they carry around. But even like the really complicated ones can still be carried. You know, like when I was in New York in Washington Square Park, one of these guys was just carrying his drone around. Lots of people were carrying their drones around, and it looks cool.
Well, your piece suggests that in the coming years, there's going to be a lot more drones, that they could be as popular as smartphones. What kinds of things do we need to do to prepare for a future like that?
Well, I guess learn how to work them, or, you know, it would be a start. But I think one of the problems is that they're not very, you know, there's problems with the navigation. They crash all the time. I mean, the military drones go down pretty regularly, and these little ones just crash all the time. So they have to figure out a way that they can fly through the civilian airspace without smashing into other airplanes.
Did you get, when you were investigating this story, did you get to try flying one or watch someone else operating them?
Well, when we were in Washington Square Park, there was a guy who was flying his own drone. And the person I was with, like the drone expert, it was kind of sweet. I mean, he was watching him, you know, like the way you'd watch a little kid in a playground. You know, he's sort of like in the beginning stages of drone operation. So, and they, you know, I've seen them fly around before, and I've seen the big ones too, though I haven't seen them in the air, just on the ground.
In terms of, you know, whether or not there's going to be a next generation of drones, you know, we talked about how they're pretty much model airplanes, but how have they changed and where are they going in terms of sophistication?
Well, there are lots of hopes for them in terms of their commercial prospects. You know, people are hoping to cash in on them, and that means making them more reliable and also probably being able to carry small things, you know, again, like delivering stuff would be like a really nice thing for drones to be able to do. But making that reliable is kind of, it's still pretty much in the future because there's too many problems with the design.
So I wouldn't, if I wanted to build and make my own drone, $500 does sound like kind of a lot, and I'm pretty technically inept. But assuming I decided I could overcome those hurdles, where would I even go to get one of these things?
There's lots of places you can go online. They have different, you know, parts you can order, and there's all kinds of instructions and things like that. I mean, it's a whole world. You know, these people go out on the weekend, they fly their drones, and then some of, like, the more entrepreneurial ones will go off on their own and do these crazy stunts. But it's, you know, there's plenty of people who would be able to give you advice on it.
Well, what about what the drones will, I guess, cost in coming ages? If they're $500 now, do you see them getting, you know, to be pretty sophisticated, something that you need to have more money to do?
Yeah, I mean, the cost will, you know, at the more elaborate level, the cost will also go down. So you'll be able to have one that can do stuff that will supposedly make your life easier, and it won't cost that much. But, you know, it's a tool, and it can be used for good or for bad. And also there's something to be said for being actually in the place yourself rather than sending a drone. You know?
How far can they fly?
It varies. I mean, the big ones like the Reaper or the Predator, they can fly for hundreds of miles. The little ones just go, you know, a mile or so, or some of them can only fly a few feet before they crash.
Wait, so the recreational drones can go hundreds of miles?
No, the big ones, like the Reaper or the Predator.
Okay, gotcha. So the little ones are smaller.
Yeah.
That makes more sense. All right.
All right, Tara, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're You're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
That's Tara McKelvey. She's a features writer for the BBC. Now, Veronica, I know a lot of our listeners are crafty maker types. I'm wondering, if you're out there and you've made a drone, you've built a kit and fly it around, go to the Central Time Facebook page, if you would, and tell us about it, or better yet, give us a picture or maybe a video you did of a flyover of your neighborhood. Over that's Central Time on WPR. Just wondering if there are any drone hobbyists out there.
Or they could fly one by Vilas Hall right now. We can see it on our window.
Only if they bring a burrito or donuts. Burrito. They're lighter than the average burrito.
All of that sounds good. Well, you can go ahead and do that on the Central Time Facebook page and, you know, drop us a comment about other stuff while you're there, too. We always appreciate hearing from you.